welcome everybody to episode 258 of the Metabolist 2 podcast, which features myself, Ben.
And I am David, and this podcast episode, we are continuing on with our look at Harry Sullivan as portrayed by Ian Martyr, with the final two televised appearances of Harry, and that would be Terror of the Zygons and the Android Invasion.
Android Invasion, exactly, yes.
And I think we had the conclusion last time that the ship had sailed on SS Sullivan with the Revenge of the Cybermen. The production team was writing him out.
Yeah, easing him out. There is, again, there's a dying fall with him in Zygons. I mean, he starts out reasonably strong, but then it just kind of fades away really a little bit, I feel. Mm-hmm. I mean, he does get to act being a Zygon, which mm-hmm. I think, you know, is obviously a fun thing to do. And that barn scene is like crazy, crazy good scene.
Yeah, so I think for an actor, Ian Martyr, the Terror of the Zygons gave him stuff to work with in the first few episodes. Even a little bit of heroic bits, not just being the evil shape-changing Zygon. But like you say, as soon as he puts back on the naval uniform, he's done.
Yeah.
He's just kind of in the background with very few lines, and it's mostly yes, sir. He's back. He's basically back in the command structure of unit, and the Brigadier is given orders, and he's saying yes, sir. And, you know, right away, sir.
Which, pointing that out, I mean, it kind of makes sense. You know, I mean, he's a military man. He's a naval lieutenant. Mm-hmm. Of course, he's back in unit. The Brigadier's his CO. He's going to be giving him the orders, and he's going to be obeying them. I mean, I guess, you know, you could say that maybe there is some subtlety here, is that you see Lieutenant Sullivan stop being a Doctor Who assistant and return to being a, you know, head of the sick bay at unit. And that possibly the character of Harry Sullivan prefers to be head of the sick bay unit rather than gallivanting around the stars getting shot at by Cybermen.
Yeah, it does bookend very nicely with Robot. It's a return to form. And just as Harry was kind of an unexpected companion at the end of Robot, he kind of fades softly into the night, returning back to form as a member of unit.
Yeah, they start out, and it's actually kind of a shame that everyone starts out wearing all their Scottish gear, and, you know, Harry's wearing the Doctor's scarf, and
yeah,
the Doctor's wearing a tartan scarf, and blah blah blah. It's, and, you know, the Brigadier's in a kilt, and then, you know, after that first episode, everyone just starts wearing the normal clothes again, which is a bit of a shame. But it is actually kind of, I mean, I was funny watching the Harry Sullivan character, you know, being kind of carefree, and I'm just going to wear the Doctor's scarf,
right?
And whether that's, you know, whether that's Ian Martyr being carefree or whether that's Harry Sullivan being carefree, who knows? But they've come off a, you know, another pretty horrifying adventure, but, you know, that's fine. Mm-hmm. As usual, and you know, let's all swap clothes around. I'm just going to wear the Doctor's mm-hmm. scarf for a bit, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, I think it's something that they probably worked out in rehearsals, or, you know, Camfield inspired moment, because Sarah's wearing the Doctor's hat too, so it's inspired by the Doctor wearing the tam o'shanter and the plaid scarf.
Yeah,
it does work. And the restored scene, or the return scene, where he's talking about Slivy Toves and Jabberwockies, he does kind of... Ian Martyr has really nice shading of actorial approaches when he is portraying different aspects of Harry, and then Harry being possessed by, or not possessed, but being a Zygon. And,
right.
And then a little bit later of Android Harry, and he has subtleties to his performance, and I think you're right. It does reflect upon him when he's back to being, instead of Harry Sullivan, Doctor Who companion, Harry Sullivan, Sergeant Lieutenant in the Royal Navy, you know, assigned to unit. He has a different way of speaking. He has a different way of carrying his body. His body language is different. It's a very subtle but sophisticated portrayal of Harry Sullivan that Martyr does.
Yeah, you know, he knows his place, and the man has been presented as a, you know, as a kind of old fashioned hero, kind of military buffoon of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
But the flip side to that is, you know, military buffoons know where they stand, and they stand in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't have the, one could say, that he has discovered within himself, that he does not have the character to go on cosmic adventures with a Time Lord. What he's best at is looking after the troops in the sick bay and being one of the Brigadier's right-hand men when it comes to tackling alien invasions on Earth. But to go out into space, that could be something that the Surgeon Lieutenant really isn't that into.
Or another interpretation would be after kind of the meltdown of the Doctor and Sarah's behavior in Revenge of the Cybermen, that
screw you,
Harry's back on Earth and is sort of like, you know, I don't want to be the butt of the jokes. Harry saved the Doctor's life several times. He was very kind to Sarah. And it's a return. If you look at the characterization between Sarah and Harry in Genesis and Sarah and Harry in Zygons, it's very, very similar. And the anomaly is in Revenge of the Cybermen. And it's just day and night that, you know, they're all friends again. And it's just very weird coming off Revenge of the Cybermen where, like I said, revenge is such an anomaly in these three characters' relationship.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they've, I'm sure they've had an adventure in between. Maybe they've gone to Floriana at last and had a lovely time on the beach.
Yeah.
And are feeling all kind of relaxed. And they made up their differences. And Harry said, like, look, guys, can you stop bullying me? Mm-hmm. And the Doctor and Sarah have gone like, yeah, we love you, Harry, but you're kind of a jerk. And he goes, yeah, I know. I'm really not cut out for this kind of thing. Mm. You know, when we get back to Earth, you know, I'll deal whatever invasion the Brigadier is concerned about right now. But then I'm just going to stay.
Yeah.
And everyone goes, fine, yeah, okay, mm-hmm. do that, Harry. And the Doctor and Sarah don't mind because the Doctor and Sarah have each other and they don't really need someone else to help them.
They don't need the third wheel.
They do not need a third wheel. And Harry, you know, Harry knows. He knows his position. He knows that he's the third wheel. He knows that he's the tin dog. And he gently bows out by just taking the train. Yeah. And luckily, it's not like a space train that gets derailed in some way. But it's a normal train. He lives happily ever after.
So one question I would have with this is, if Hinchcliffe and Holmes had decided to continue on in Barry Lett's unit family thing, Harry Sullivan is primed to be the Mike Yates and kind of take over that role.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. And I think there's a similar arc there. You know, if Harry Sullivan was designed originally to be Sarah Jane Smith's boyfriend, it's just not going to happen, basically, because the Doctor and Sarah have the relationship. Mm-hmm. So that would fall flat. And I think, you know, you potentially would get an arc that was roughly similar to Mike Yates and something would happen with Harry and he would, you know, have to
make a choice
between his, I don't know what kind of crisis of conscience he'd have similar to Mike. He doesn't seem to be nearly as sensitive or as thoughtful as Mike Yates is portrayed, susceptible to the blandishments of alien forces and seductive people who want to return to the Golden Age. Anyway, carry on. Sorry, yeah. Couldn't find the words.
Yeah, it would be something where Harry would have a conflict between doing his duty and preserving his own self-preservation. So if you think back to like the Silurian plague, if there was some kind of return of a deadly plague on Earth, and it would be Harry who self-sacrifices himself in order to find the cure I would imagine some more of a noble ending or a self-sacrificial ending for Harry. Instead, if we look at both Zygons and Android Invasion, he sort of fades. He's there at the end with Terror of the Zygons, but he just doesn't even, the Doctor doesn't even say goodbye to him at the end of Androids. It's really just brutal in that way. It's sort of like, this is a guy who traveled with you for a season and, you know, not even the time of day.
Well, I mean, the Doctor can be a jerk about things like that, to be honest. The Baker Doctor can be moody and he can be a jerk. And, you know, without putting too much of a post modern spin on it, the Doctor is excited to go away with Sarah because they're great together, and you know there's no, you know, relationship going on between those two. But there's certainly, whereas with the third Doctor and Joe, you know, it was a father-daughter relationship. the relationship between the Fourth Doctor and Sarah is a different one, and it's actually harder to characterize. It's obviously not a sexual one, because that's not something that would happen. It's a friendship, definitely. But it's almost, actually, you know, I mean, I think in some ways it's the kind of relationship that Russell T. Davies was writing for Rose and the Tenth Doctor, where they just become these kind of freewheeling, cosmic, having fun people who just kind of ricochet from crisis to crisis, solving them and going on to the next one.
It's interesting reading that Harry Sullivan is the third wheel, and
yeah,
they get rid of Harry as soon as they can.
yeah, he's definitely the gooseberry. Yeah, he's like, what the hell? What's this guy who's hanging around? We're just trying to have fun and like foil some alien plots. And there's this like naval jerk who's just like following us about. Like, go away, naval jerk. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the you know the bullying that you made, the kind of quasi bullying that you pointed out in Revenge is, mm-hmm. you know, potentially, if we were going to read it this way, is absolutely part of that. You know,
yeah,
they're really kind of ganging up on him. That whole kind of, you know, Harry Sullivan is a big, what is he, big fat
imbecile.
That's yeah. it. You know, that's bullying basically, mm-hmm. Because he's not, and as you pointed out, he wasn't mm-hmm. being an imbecile. He was trying his best, and you know, and it kind of ends up some way saving a day of some mm-hmm. kind. So that's just the Doctor being a bully.
Yeah, and it's not like Harry hasn't learned through his travels with the Doctor. If you compare it back to Ark in Space, where he's randomly pushing buttons, he's not randomly pushing buttons anymore.
He's not.
You know, hands by his side, helping when he can. And he isn't as clumsy as I think the fan wisdom is of Harry. I think it's really comes down to perhaps Revenge being the oldest and most available home video, since it was the first release on VHS. And
oh, interesting, yeah.
That portrayal of Harry Sullivan may outweigh at least fans of our generation more than any others. You know, it'd be interesting to see what maybe younger fans think of Harry because of DVD and Blu-ray and streaming, of course.
That's interesting. Yeah, no, I had that. That's an excellent point. It was the only videotape available for a short while, for a while, and it was the first one. I mean, you know, I never, I can't remember when I first saw. I must have rented the tape, but I mean, at that point, it had been reprinted a couple of times. The kind of original one, I think, was actually kind of hard to find, to be honest.
Yeah.
Tape wise. But yeah, no, I haven't thought of that. Well, I mean, presuming in the US, these shows were just shown in order and then rotated, right?
Yeah, you would have the Tom Baker on rotation. So I saw Harry like three or four times in my teenagehood. So
right.
Honestly, it wasn't until watching specifically Ian Martyr's performance and what Harry was up to for our last podcast that I really honed in on. Ooh.
Right.
This is really, really pretty abusive on right. Sarah and the Doctor's part.
Yeah, because it is actually, you know, if you want to take these as real, which, you know, obviously we have to, I mean, or we like to.
Right.
You know, these are pretty risky and frightening and difficult and dangerous situations that all these people are in on a constant basis. Mm-hmm. And as Douglas Canfield will tell you, as a military man, like, you can't be, if the Doctor is like the leader, he cannot countenance any, he should not be countenancing any kind of bullying or insubordination or breaking down of the unit, mm-hmm. because these are dangerous situations. Both Harry and Sarah need to be ready to react in order to get the job done, and the Doctor needs to bolster that rather than breaking it down. And in some ways, you know, it maybe kind of reinforces this idea of the Fourth Doctor as a kind of a dangerous character, as a maverick, mm-hmm. As someone who doesn't play by the rules, kind of person, who will, you know, recklessly undermine, you know, a member of his team just for laughs.
Yeah, and we do see that carry on, that kind of prickliness and undermining when Leela replaces Sarah.
Well, that's true. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, again, you know, you get a weird crossover between the character of Tom Baker in the colony room with Francis Bacon and the Fourth Doctor in the in his TARDIS swanning around the universe. You know, there is a weird kind of crossover there, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. Blending a personage.
Exactly. I mean, I will have to say, though, I mean, again, I saw Zygons relatively recently, but then watching it again, it is so brilliantly directed.
Yes.
I mean, Douglas Camfield was, oh, wow. Just like, and the whole, all the military stuff is just so on point.
Very much so.
And it's just a joy, basically. It's so much fun.
Yeah.
And the old-fashioned Zygons, everybody must agree, are just so much better than the new Zygons, who look shit, compared to the ones from the 70s, which literally does not make sense, but there you go.
So just a couple points just that you raised there. With the way the actors who are soldiers carried themselves in the Zygons, it's night and day to how they carry themselves in the Android Invasion.
Absolutely, yes.
Very, very obvious contrast. And the scene where Benton's leading his men up a slight hill, searching after Zygon's Orla, who played the sister.
Right.
Just the ease that those men were with their firearms going up there. And it looked soldierly, and opposed to kind of the woodenness that you would see with the direction in the Android Invasion that Barry Letts would have the soldiers be. So there's this comfort and naturalness of portraying soldiers not a new thought that Camfield brings up.
Yeah.
The other thing is when Sarah is chasing after Zygon, Harry, look at the way she runs with the unit squaddies compared to the way that she runs in,
right,
even in the Android Invasion. True. Liz is running like a normal person in Terror of the Zygons, and she's, you know, she's running like the stereotypical stage girl in the Android Invasion. And I don't know if that's just Camfield saying, no, Liz, run like this.
Yeah, run like hell. Come on. Yeah,
or,
run.
You know, Barry Letts saying, no, I want you to be a little more
ladylike,
helpless.
Yeah.
I don't know, but
in some ways, I mean, they're both outside. You know, they're both on location. I mean, I guess maybe running down a rainy piece of asphalt is kind of easier than kind of running through a wood, in terms of getting the shot.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, the kind of general patheticness of Sarah in some ways in Android Invader, falling down a cliff unconvincingly, spraining her ankle a little bit, running about like a girl. It's, you know, it's so different from, you know, the kind of commanding, you know, she's leading those troops
right
down that road, and they're belting after her. She's running as well. And they've all got their berets on straight. They've all got their weapons held correctly.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely convincing that this is some kind of military setup.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, I mean, it's ironic, actually, to say this. There is nothing about the Android Invasion that is remotely convincing, which I guess is kind of the point.
Right, maybe.
I don't think it is the point, but it is funny to think a story that is that is about things not being real doesn't really seem to be real.
Mm-hmm. And speaking to the direction of Camfield, Martyr has a lot to work with in Zygons, at least in the first episodes. You know, he's actively pursuing the investigation, looking at the medical records from the wrecks, and then he's driving a Land Rover and then sees Monroe coming out of the sea and staggering, and he's by him when he gets shot by the Caber.
Mm-hmm.
And that which raises me a question. I'm assuming that Britain does not have carte blanche, trespassers will be shot. I mean, this is, Monroe is murdered by Zygon
Caber.
The Caber. Yeah. I'm assuming this would be a problem anywhere. This is not normal behavior.
Yeah, you're not. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a clue to us, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really seem to be a clue to any character in the show that both the Duke and the Caber are not human.
Right.
Because that is literally something that you're not allowed to do. And even, and you know, the most well, you know, a better informed alien invader would also realize that that's not the kind of thing you're supposed to do, probably not do it.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously Broton is reckless. He's really making a play for, you know, conquering the Earth and going to wave his tentacles from the balcony. Shoot to kill, which is like, well, no, you're actually not allowed to do that, the Duke
right.
of Forgill, whatever the hell you are.
Broton.
Broton. That is that should be instant arrest. Mm-hmm. But, and they should, the police should be there. There should be a little cordon around the body, taking forensics,
right.
Take the bullet. Where did the bullet come from? Who's got high-powered rifles? That's a very reckless thing for the Zygons to do, because that potentially brings down the entire force of the Scottish police onto Broton's plan, which, you know, he doesn't really need that quite yet. But anyway.
Doesn't need that attention. No. And so that's sort of like a plot hole, a loose end on that. I mean, it's very dramatic. It gets Harry shot, but it does. It's sort of like, why wasn't the death of Monroe and the shooting of Harry followed up on?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could quite easily plug that one up by having Monroe die in Harry's arms because he's, you know, been in the sea for 24 hours and is half drowned and you know, there's hypothermia. And then, you know, the caber grazes Harry with a bullet and Harry falls to the ground and like, oh, I'm unconscious because I've been hit by a bullet. And then, you know, the bullet, who knows where the bullet came from, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact you've got a dead body with a bullet in it shot by someone, that's something that the, you know, you've got the bullet at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And you should then be able to, using forensics, you'd be able to work out who, you know, all the, you know, a rifle like that for deer stalking, presumably, you know, would be registered with the police.
Yeah, it's not like the U.S. where they hand them out at trick or treat.
No, you can't just go down to Walmart and, like, buy yourself a couple of rifles. They're quite well controlled, even in Scotland where, you know, there's because of, you know, deer stalking is a major sport, and you've got to have a high-powered rifle to kill a deer because, you know, they can see you from miles away because they don't live in woods, because there aren't any woods in Scotland that deer can live in. So, that's definitely a plot hole. But, I mean, one could plug that hole, again, by just saying, Broton's a jerk and, you know, really doesn't.
Reckless, yes.
He's a reckless. I mean, no wonder the Zygons got rid of it. Probably the Zygons like, oh, thank God. Like...
It's the B arc from
exactly
Hitchhiker's Guide.
Exactly, it's the B arc. It's definitely the B arc.
Their planet didn't actually. The Zygon homeworld didn't actually.
It's all a trick. It's all a trick to get rid of that
idiot of Broton.
Exactly, fucking Broton man. Thank God we got rid of him. What a jerk that guy was.
We're well done with him.
Exactly. Oh, funny.
But it does get him, or does get Harry into the sick bay as a patient, and sets up him to be abducted by Sister Lamont, which is glossed over, which is fine. But Harry is really kind of a duck out of water in the Zygon spaceship, and he is there to ask all the why, where, how questions of Broton, so Broton can do the plot dump.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Broton loves to talk about stuff. And all you got to do is, like, you know, he's absolutely a Bond villain when it comes to exposition. and you just got to give him the cues and he'll tell you his plan up to a point. He's obviously not going to say, I'm going to be going to the energy conference in London. Because we'll have to work out that for ourselves by suddenly realizing it in the third episode.
But the moment of heroism for Harry in that is when the doctor is being pursued by the Scarazin, out of nowhere, Harry kind of bursts into the Zygon control room and grabs the mushroomy, spongy controls and, I guess...
Gives them a twiddle
and gets the Zygon, or not the Zygon, the Scarazin to miss by inches or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, he's very lucky that twiddle, that particular protuberance, didn't send the Scarazin into a frenzy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but anyway, there you go.
So, but if we were talking about how Harry doesn't press random knobs and buttons that we learned in the Ark in Space, his moment of, you know, it's not focused on, but his moment of heroism in Zygon's there to save the doctor is random buttons and knobs.
Random button pressing. I mean, he's been so frustrated by not being able to press any button that he's come across that he's like, he just goes wild in the Zygon spaceship and presses all the buttons he can find because it feels so good. It feels so good to press buttons.
And then they drag him out by his arms.
There you go. Those Zygons. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do? It's a similar arc of activity than we've had in the sort of previous couple of stories. It starts out reasonably strong, but
Yeah.
By the end, they've run out of things to write for him, basically.
And for an actor, and Ian Martyr, from all accounts, would get very bored with what he was being given. He got something crunchy to work on when he was the Zygon.
Right.
And the way that Ian Martyr portrayed Zygon Harry was, you know, brilliant. It was spooky. It was ominous. It was foreshadowed back in the scene that was restored with the slivy toes.
Right.
With the Lewis Carroll quote. It just showed off the kind of caliber of acting that Murder has. And basically, that's the last time we see it, unfortunately. Because it's...
Kind of, yeah.
Unfortunately, if you're looking at these stories back to back, it's another story of possession or fake Harry with Android Harry in the Android Invasion.
Yeah. Yeah, he's kind of playing the same character. I mean, he's more of an android than a Zygon, but he's still not himself.
Right.
And it is actually kind of interesting, you know, that we're back to shape-shifting doubles, which is kind of what we have with Zygons. And it is, I mean, Android Invasion is weird. It is like massively... I was going to say unimaginative, but like dependent on just doing the same kind of thing again. Here are some doubles.
Mm-hmm.
Here are some bickering scientists with masks on and there's only two of them, which is like Revenge of the Cybermen, I'm going to say. You know, it's like Terror of the Ortons. They come via meteorites. Mm-hmm. It's like the Ambassadors of Death because it's the British space program. So, yeah, it's a shame, actually, because, I mean, there's some fun stuff in it. It's just daft all the way through, though, basically.
Mm-hmm. I think as an actor, if I was Ian Martyr, if I wasn't, I don't know, it was a paycheck, right? But it certainly didn't do the character any favors.
No.
And Nick Courtney was probably well clear of it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I can't remember, who's the Colonel? Colonel Crayford.
Faraday.
Faraday. I was going to say Frobisher, but no, it's Faraday, isn't it?
Faraday,
I mean,
yeah.
Colonel Faraday is just an idiot. Mm-hmm. And I think in some ways, I don't know whether, you know, they rewrote the part when Nick Courtney wasn't available or whether Nick Courtney took one look at that part and go like, that's not the Brigadier, I'm not doing that.
Right.
But yeah, he's not the Brigadier. The Brigadier wouldn't have been androided in the first place, maybe. Or maybe he would have been androided, who knows. But yeah, no, he's just kind of a fool.
And you had commented previously that the Seeds of Doom having Harry and the Antarctic base would have been a much better return for Harry.
A really good send off for him.
Either he dies trying to cure the crinoid plague, or he's killed by the rogue crinoid or something like that, or even just calling in the doctor, getting rid of the World Ecology Bureau. But
yeah,
just sort of the misuse of Harry towards the end is just exemplified or amplified by the misuse of UNIT towards the end. It's just Hinchcliffe and Holmes really don't know what to do with it, with the task force.
Yeah, I mean, they don't like the army particularly that much. Well, they're not interested in those army stories.
No.
Which is fair. I mean, why should they be? And their lack of interest means it kind of falls away. They're not kind of punching up the bad bits of script about UNIT. They're just kind of letting them ride because they don't really care that much.
Yeah.
You know what would be great? Harry should have been the one who was taken over by the crinoid pod.
Oh, that would have been brutal.
Oh, wouldn't that have been horrible? And yeah. Ian Martyr would have like lent into that like 100% if he'd been the pod. Can't remember who the guy who gets podded is. Can't remember. Anyway, yeah, I mean, that would have been awesome. He would have really sold the shit out of that, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been horrific to us kids. So
see Harry go, yeah.
Yeah, so they probably wouldn't have let him do it, to be honest. But he would have loved to have done that. I can guarantee it that he would have been all over that. But anyway, there you go.
Ian Martyr was a good actor, and it's just a shame that they couldn't give him more things to do. And I wonder, career-wise, if him taking on... you know, a family children's television serial was the best career move for him, even though it was regular work for half a year.
I mean, who knows? I mean, I think, I think you and I would have to talk to someone who knew him better to work out exactly what he was really feeling. Mm-hmm. Obviously he needed work. Obviously he needed to support his family.
Right.
Obviously his health wasn't in the best place.
Right, because coming off of Carnival of Monsters, he was in hospital up until the time he was offered the role in Robot.
Right. And again, I think we've hypothesized that, you know, taking on these novelizations was maybe another way to make money from his English degree, which wasn't the kind of the grind of acting in rep or even, you know, the hard work of acting on the television. And then with a young family, again, that's difficult. And then again, if you weren't, you know, you weren't sure that you wanted to be married to your wife anymore because maybe you like men better, that's another thing. So, you know, all these things pile up. I think we've already discussed how, you know, he possibly wasn't the happiest, which is sad because he's such a, you know, this performance as Harry Sullivan is one that's very special to people of our age. And his character is a very special one. And
he's unique in the 70s.
And it's sad. I personally find it sad thinking about Ian Marta and thinking about how he possibly wasn't happy in his life and how he died age 44. And, you know, he had another 40 years of acting that he could have given us. All of the, you know, the great golden age of ITV / BBC drama in the 80s, you know, Brideshead Revisited and, you know, what's the one where they're all in India? I can't remember what it's called now.
Passage to India?
Not Passage to India. Anyway, all those ones. You know, he could have been in all of that. He could have been a TV detective. He could have been Shoestring, for God's sake. Right. Pretty easily. You know, I mean, he was a really good actor, and he could have been a lot. He could have gone genre. He could have gone, like, Shakespeare. He could have gone prestige TV drama. You know, and unfortunately, he didn't. Because he couldn't, because he died.
Yeah, he died at age on his 42nd birthday. Unfortunately,
it was his 42nd birthday. Right. Okay. I thought he was
born in 44, died in age 42.
42, which is, you know, a really young age to die. Yeah. I mean, absolutely not the right age to die.
And if you look at just his writing, getting back into his writing, he would have been totally all over the Virgin New Adventures line. If you went to him saying,
yes,
I want, you know, here's the Doctor. We want to tell little more adult stories, little more edgy, little more gritty. Exactly what he was doing in the Target novels, even with the Harry Sullivan War. He would have just been a perfect match for the Virgin New Adventures and even the Missing Adventures, the range. I would just have loved to read what he would have written with Tom Doctor and Sarah and his character and all the characters.
Oh, yeah. You 100% on the mark there. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I just looked up. Julian the Crown was the TV show I was thinking of, where they're all in India doing things with Charles Dance, etc.
Yeah, and he would have fit with his ability to play the upper classes and the soldierly classes.
Right.
He would have been a perfect fit within that type of drama, or even in going back with Camfield. I think Camfield had Beau Guest.
Right,
and,
right.
He was known by these directors. He would have been cast, I think, and I think he would have been a really good fit for him. And unfortunately, his heart attack took him away from his family and from us fans.
Right. Yeah. I mean, thinking about Julian the Crown again, mm-hmm. I think that was the first major role for Charles Dance. And Charles Dance was born. Yeah. Breakthrough screen role was 1984 miniseries, the Julian the Crown. Dance was born in 46. Marta was born in 44. I could see Ian Marta being a Charles Dance. You know, being in Game of Thrones, you know, dressing up in drag for whatever that one where Charles Dance dresses up in drag is called. Can't remember what it's called now. Anyway, yeah, I mean, he's. I think he was that good an actor, and I think he was that versatile an actor, and I think he was that adventurous as an actor mm-hmm. as well. And I think it's. I think we really were. I mean, obviously, you know, the people who knew him and loved him were the people who really robbed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think as a culture, we were robbed by his death, and it's sad. It's a source of sadness, I think, really.
And I think we had posited way back when we had started looking at Ian's career towards the end my hunch is that his struggles with diabetes, his health issues was preventing him from taking on acting roles.
Right.
And so the writing would provide an income, and he was very good at it. I do prefer Ian Martyr's Target novelizations over almost everyone else's.
They certainly lean into what we were watching Doctor Who for, which was the grittiness and the action and the violence is the kind of stuff that we wanted, and he really kind of gave it to us in those novelizations.
For me, it's just his descriptions are much more lush and full than what the economical style that Terence Dix had.
Yeah, of course.
And mm-hmm. So whether it's reading English at Oxford or just he's a very smart individual, as can be seen by getting a scholarship to going to St. Edmund Hall, that he understood how stories and literature and description and dialogue all work together. And I think he was a very good writer that was just starting to build upon that as a career before he died.
And right.
More original works rather than just novelizations, I think, would have been in his future. And I think his writing shows that he had the caliber to pull that off.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. Agreed. Yep. So, we were robbed.
Speaking of which, did you ever get a hold of Splash?
I do have a copy of Splash. I've not actually... I read the first couple of pages like, this is a novelization of Splash. I'll have to say, people who are eagerly awaiting my analysis of Splash, I haven't done it yet. I've not understood the assignment. I've not completed my homework. Well, I've not got more than 3 or 4 pages into Splash so far.
We'll save it for the long winter evenings.
You know what would be good? I will save it for Big Finish doing an adaptation of it.
There you go.
Yeah, exactly.
Get on that, Nick.
I guess what I realized is I've not seen Splash since it came out. And then I wasn't really willing to pay a lot of attention to it. I should read it because it would be interesting to see how Marta novelizes something that he wasn't involved in and potentially novelizes something that he wasn't that interested in.
Well, we get a glimpse of that with his novelizations of the Hartnell and Troughton era stories, like with Reign of Terror, Invasion, Rescue, Dominators, etc.
That's true, but none of those have a loving relationship between a man and a mermaid.
That is
a
something.
Screwball relationship between Tom Hanks and a mermaid.
They say Doctor Who is a genre machine, and that is a genre that the interspecies mermaid human romance just has not been addressed in current Doctor Who. And
it could happen.
RTD will
Come
be
on.
All over that in the
exactly.
next Gatwa season 3, which I guess is on but not on.
Well,
Gatwa said it was on, and that was off topic, but
we've got the War Between the Land and the Sea barreling down on top of us. Obvious, like the mermaids are the good guys. The doctor has like a crush on a merman.
There you go.
Who's all like hunky and like bare chested with a tail. It's this stuff writes itself. Really, come on. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hunky merman falls for
merhunk.
Merhunk falls for doctor. Merhunk. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, finally a use for the swimming pool in the TARDIS.
That's where the merman could live. He could live in the swimming pool. Though I seem to remember, doesn't Daryl Hannah like get legs and stuff by the end of Splash?
It would be a shame if Daryl Hannah didn't have legs by the end of Splash.
Yeah, I think she gets legs. In some magical way. So I guess, the merhunk could get legs as well and just be like a hunk. Just be lounging around the TARDIS like, just like someone who's lounging around. Yeah.
What do you call him? Let's see. Wouldn't be there.
David Prowse in The Clockwork Orange. What?
I was going to say, wouldn't be the rogue. It'd be more like the...
The flounder or something. Or the...
the flounder.
The hammerhead shark.
The shark.
Shark. I'm going to call you Shark. Sharky for short. Yeah.
There you go.
Perfect.
All right. Well, we're way off topic.
Way off topic now, which...
Thank you to the novelization of Splash, which we gave a pass to.
Yeah, it wasn't that much. I'm looking at it right now on my bookshelves. Maybe I'll take it down after this podcast and read another couple of pages. We could certainly supplementary 5 minutes review in a later podcast if I ever get around to reading it. It's nice to have on the shelves, though. I enjoy having books that are written by people that are different from the books that they regularly write, and they wrote them under a different name. I've got a little section in my library of people like that, so it's nice to have in that way.
Wrote it under Ian Don.
It's under Ian Don. Yes. Well, it's in the trashy paperback section of my library, because I guess that's kind of what it is. But.
Definitely a loss to the Doctor Who, to his family, to acting in general, and really not fairly dismissed or signed off. Much like many other companions of the classic series, did not have a really good send-off for Harry Sullivan.
No, and they don't, do they? I mean, you know, I think that's pretty standard for classic era companions. They kind of get thrown to one side by an incoming production team.
Could have gotten married off to the real Sister Lamont.
Yeah, they could have walked off.
or the caber.
Arm in arm with the caber. and Sister Lamont, like a threesome, like a thruple. I mean, I think that would have been perfect.
Another triad.
Yeah.
There you go. Yep. Way ahead of its time.
Way ahead of
1975.
Oh, funny. I think that would have worked very well. Because the caber turns out to be like a really nice bloke and like really helpful and like not a murderous man at all. Like and the caber's great. I like the caber very much. When he's not a Zygon.
Yeah, well, Robert Russell was in Witchfinder's General with Vincent Price.
This is what I understand from reading around the subject. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so this was his two big roles, Doctor Who and Witchfinder General. So.
I'm sure he died happy if he's dead. I don't know. I certainly would die happy if I was in those two things.
All right, well... Are we done?
I think we're done. We wish he was here, and he's not, and that is a source of sadness.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for listening to episode 258 of the Metabulous 2 podcast. I have been contemplating what kind of Zygon form I would shapeshift from with Ben.
And I have been consistently failing to read Splash by Ian Don with David.
Ah, until next time, in another three pages.
Farewell.
So what follows is a bit of a bonus. It's an interview from August 19th, 1984, which I first heard about 10 years ago in 2014 on Doctor Who Podshock episode 306 with Louis Trapani. And this is an interview from the Chuck Robb Show, which was on a Philadelphia FM station on WPEB. This interview, the excerpt, is of Ian Martyr and with a brief bit of Sarah Sutton in there towards the end. And the interview took place in a hotel lobby at a convention, and it's pretty hard to, well, it was pretty hard to hear on the original over the lobby music. I've tried to remove as much lobby music as possible, and it really brought out Ian's voice, and it's pretty clear when Ian is talking, but it's still hard to hear when Chuck Robb and his team are doing the interviews. So hopefully this has some merit to listen to. And of course, a big thank you to Louis Trapani for giving the okay to repodcast this interview of Chuck Robb from 1984. And so without further comment, here is Ian.
Joel Spivak, Brendan O'Hara. My name is Chuck Robb. Ian, how did you get involved with Dr.
Well, the very beginning of it was when I was asked to go and see Barry Letts, who in those days was the producer of the program, about a new character who was going to be brought in as a unit officer in unit. And it was the part of a young captain. And I went to see Barry for this part. And it then transpired that I wasn't going to be available anyway. Whether they would have asked me to do it, I don't know. And Richard Franklin, I think, played the part in the end. So I didn't play that part. But then later, when again a sort of military character came up, Barry again was still the producer, and he must have thought of me from the previous contact that I'd had with him when he was casting before. And he cast me as a character in a John Pertwee story called, now I've forgotten the name. Some of your American experts here. Yeah, we all have to always call on the Americans to tell us. My mind just goes blank about those details. Carnival of Monsters, which was a story with John Pertwee. And then that was a character different from the one I eventually played. And then when Tom Baker came in 1974-75, they weren't at the time quite sure who they were going to have as the Doctor, and they thought maybe it's going to be somebody, shall we say, a little advanced in years. And so maybe we need somebody to crash through plate glass windows and leap off of high buildings. So they invented this character called Harry Sullivan, who I played in the end. When Tom was cast, it immediately became apparent, of course, that they weren't going to need somebody to do all these things, because Tom was perfectly capable of doing them himself. So they then had to sort of rethink fairly quickly and rejig the character, and he became a sort of well-meaning English gentleman, whatever that is. And
at least he wasn't a complete non-entity.
No, that's right. I hope not, no. I had a suspicion that the writers always found it a bit difficult to write for him. I always had that rather uneasy feeling that they weren't beside themselves with enthusiasm for the character.
If I remember correctly, Harry Sullivan does solve some cases by the end of the series.
Yeah.
In chapter 4 or 5, he can get rid of one of the monsters. But he's basically following instructions and may not realize exactly what he's doing. He's asking.
That's right, yes. It's that old thing of, does the Doctor do everything himself, or does he really rely on the people around him? We used to have arguments about this, and it's one of my hobby horses, which I'm now going to be stand by because I'm now going to be very boring, but it is one of my hobby horses. If you have a big star character, I'm not talking about the actor or actress who plays the character, but a star character, if you surround that character with very minor, ineffectual characters, you don't actually enhance the status of the star. You actually bring it down. It has a contrary effect, in my judgment. You know, we used to have a very famous actor called Sir Donald Woolfit. It was a great sort of ham, wasn't he? Really? Wasn't he?
Yeah.
No disrespect. He was a wonderful actor, but he was a great tearaway actor. And he used to deliberately surround himself with rather minor actors so that he wouldn't be able to... But all it actually did was bring him down. He didn't seem to realize. I don't want to go on about Donald Wolfe particularly, but do you know what I mean? If you want to make a character, build a character up, you have to put big characters next to them. I don't know how I got onto this tack, but it's all to do with the whole thing of grading and getting the temperature right all the way around. It's okay having an omnipotent character who can do anything. If the Doctor's too capable, then there's no danger, and he's not being, he stops being interesting. He's only an interesting character if he's vulnerable.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I've gone a very long way about saying it, but it's I think it's true not just of Doctor Who, of any program like that, you know.
I'd like to know what kind of things you've been doing since the London show.
This is where my rusty memory gets called back into action. Well, I did quite a lot of theatre. I didn't do anything on television for quite some time. I did do a series called Crown Court, which is a sort of three half-hour episodes on three successive days in the week around lunchtime, when they have a courtroom drama. But the outcome is unknown. What they do is they have a jury which is made up of real members of the public who could be called on to be members of real juries. They're not extras. They're not actors. They're nothing to do with any scripted role at all. And they simply come in once the whole thing's been rehearsed for the studio. They come in on the studio day and act as a real jury. And what we had, I was an attorney, and I used to play a regular sort of attorney in the thing. And we presented our cases as best we could, and then the jury considered their verdict. And it was quite exciting. It
sounds like a great training for lawyers.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Well, you really did. We used to write our own summings up for the end of the trial, you know, with the attorneys. I imagine they do here, give a kind of summary of their case before the jury retires. We often used to write those ourselves. On the basis of how we felt the thing had gone. And then, the outcome was a real unknown quantity. I did quite a lot of those. I then went and did some work with the Bristol Old Vic, which is a provincial rep company. I did some West End shows. Then I went abroad and came back to the UK, did some more theatre, went abroad again. Then I started doing the writing, started doing the adaptations, stuff like that. So I've been doing rather more of that lately than I have acting.
Did you ever watch the Doctor Who show?
Yes, I did. I didn't watch it regularly. I saw the very first episode ever in 1963 with Bill Hartnell. I didn't watch it regularly. Again, I think I was at school at the time, university by then. So I wasn't always able to see it. But I watched odd ones the way through, you know. I didn't see many of Patrick Troughton's. I saw more of Pertwee's. I wasn't a fan exactly, but when I watched them, I enjoyed them, you know.
Watch it now?
Yes, I do. I don't watch it regularly, again, because I'm perhaps aware or something. Or I forget, or I don't have a television at the time.
Yes, I'd like to ask, what was it like leaving the program, and would you come back, say, for a 20th anniversary special or a 30th anniversary special?
I was rather relieved to leave it as it happened, because the way the character had been allowed to rather degenerate. And so in the end, when it was finally time to go, it really was time to go. So in a way, it was, for a sad reason, it was a relief, you know. But I don't think I would now. No, I think that's it, you know. He's run his course.
Is there any kind of part from a book or a movie that you've seen that you'd very much like to play?
That's really difficult. No, I don't. I quite like to play Jaques in As You Like It, Shakespeare play As You Like It. There isn't a part I've always wanted to play. I have never wanted to play Hamlet, I hasten to add. Never. Not that anybody's ever asked me, so, and he's never likely to. So, but I've never had any, you know, desire. I'd love to play Sherlock Holmes. Yeah, I'd love to play Sherlock Holmes. But somebody's doing that very well just at this very moment on television in the UK now. Jeremy Brett is at this moment playing Sherlock Holmes in the series. I hope you get it over here, because I think it's really good.
It is good. I've seen some. They're very good.
They're good, aren't they?
Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah. David Burke is Dr. Watson. And they're really very classy and well made. Mm. But I fancy myself as a Sherlock Holmes.
Do you think that you and Sarah might work together sometime?
Well, it would be nice.
It would be super,
yes.
The one thing about this business is you do meet up with people you think you're never going to see again. You do a show with them and you can say goodbye. And for some unknown reason, they turn up. People turn up, don't they?
Yes, that's right.
That's what's so wonderful about it.
Well, it was like John Woodnutt, who I was talking about earlier in his outfit. I was in Uncle Vanya at Liverpool, and he came up to play Professor Sarah Bryarkov. And, of course, when we saw each other, we just collapsed with laughter, and it was very irritating for the rest of the cast of the read-through, because we couldn't stop giggling. All I could see was John in that outfit with all those nipples all over it saying, I am Bruton. That's all I could think of him as. And doing the play, doing the Chekhov play, I could still see John in his outfit zip up the back. That's a bonus, I think, from the business, is the fact that you meet up with. Sometimes maybe you don't want to meet up with certain people, I don't know. It's certainly not the case here, I don't think, but no, it would be great.
Yes.
I'll look forward to that sometime in the future.
Right.
And thank you both for the show. My guest has been Ian Warner, Sarah Sutton, co-host Joel Spivak, and an occasional question by Brendan O'Hara.
Thank you. Thanks very much.